Please sit down. I remember an occasion some years ago now. I was in a church, not wildly different from this one, again part of a team. And as part of the rota, I was down to preach at this service, and one of the team vicars was leading it. And this, it was the only, I think, the only church in the team that had a regular evening service. So this was the genuine old evensong for those of us that are getting a little grey and can remember such things. And if to be tactful, I would have to say that the congregation, as you might imagine, were more sort of grandmotherly than motherly at a service like that. And it happened to be Mothering Sunday. I wasn't there because it was Mothering Sunday. I happened to be on the rota for Mothering Sunday. And Peter, the team vicar who was leading the service, we'd been getting ready in the vestry and we were just about to come out. And Peter said, "Well, I suppose we'd better go and tell them all how to be good mothers then, haven't we?" And I thought, no, I don't think I'm qualified to do that. And I'm not going to teach anybody how to be a good mother this morning. But there are, I think, in those readings, a couple of examples of qualities which are very useful, not just to mothers, but to all of us. And the first of it comes in that reading from Exodus, which, as Chris told us, is from the very beginning of the story of Moses. Let me just go back a little bit further and put it even more in context. We are the era of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, that era. Now, what is clear in the Bible, but less obvious in the show, is that the whole point of the sort of Joseph episode was to preserve the people. And Jacob and all his extended family were moved to Israel to escape the famine. And they settled happily in Egypt. We're now moved on a few years. Joseph has died. We've changed Pharaoh at least once. And guess what? Nothing's new, is it? They have a sort of slight immigration problem. Because this group of Israelites is starting to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the Egyptians are starting to get worried. You know, at one point they explain quite clearly why. You know, I mean, they were involved in fighting battles with various enemies. And they said, "Well, look, if this lot join the enemy, we're in real trouble, you know. We've lost." So there was a real concern to sort of get the numbers down, to manage it. As I say, nothing is new. Tried various things. Tried enslaving them into making bricks and building things for them. And it got the buildings up, but it didn't seem to do anything to get the numbers down. So they tried to be a little more direct, and an order was issued to the midwives to say, "Kill all the baby boys." Well, I would like to suggest that to any pharaoh that an advice to a midwife to kill a baby is not likely to be followed, if I could put it that way. They're not in that line of business. And they found some very ingenious excuses for why they hadn't done it. Read back and have a look if you want to find out. So we get to the final point, and Pharaoh says, "Right, all Hebrew baby boys will be thrown in the Nile." And that's the point that we come in. Now, Moses' mother was aware of this one, obviously, couldn't be anything but aware. And she therefore hid him for 3 months while she thought about this. What do we do? And she came up with what turned out to be a wonderful plan. She did throw him in the Nile, I mean, Pharaoh hadn't said anything about you can't make a waterproof basket and put him in before you throw him. So she did that, put him in there, but chose her place and her time very carefully. Put him in the Nile, knowing that Pharaoh's daughter was likely to come that way very shortly. Left him there. Of course, the baby cried, as babies do. They get hungry and things like that. Attracted attention. A slave was sent to retrieve basket. Everybody had a look inside. And what happened next was what I think his mother was banking on. You know how when anybody turns up in church with a new baby, all the other mums come round and go, "Oh, isn't he lovely?" And guess what Pharaoh's daughter did? "Oh, isn't he lovely?" Now, according to her dad's edict, the end of the sentence ought to be, "Throw him in the Nile." I think she thought a little more quickly than that. And she thought, well, how can I avoid, the challenge? It's all right giving an edict saying doing it, but actually standing there and doing it is quite different. And Pharaoh's daughter, at that point, bottled out and said, "I tell you what, in order to avoid it, I'll adopt him. That way, he doesn't qualify for being thrown in the Nile, does he?" And it just so happened that his sister was lurking nearby, who, prompted by her mother, no doubt, took the moment, nipped in and said, "Can I find somebody to look after him for you?" Wonderful opportunity, so Pharaoh's daughter takes it up. And guess what? His mother got paid for looking after her own baby. Now, how many mothers here would have thought that was a good idea? And we know the rest of the story. He was finally adopted as Pharaoh's daughter. But I want to just suggest to you that there's a couple of qualities there that are beautifully illustrated. One is her resourcefulness, and one is her imagination. And I would suggest to you that most mothers here would probably agree with me that you need both resourcefulness and imagination in bringing up children. They do need both qualities. There's a second one, or a second example, in our gospel reading this morning. Here we are with Mary and Joseph in the temple. They've gone to dedicate Jesus. And as they're coming out, they meet Simeon, who says to Mary, "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed. And a sword will pierce your own soul too." And of course, we know the rest of that story. Mary must have known that Jesus was going to be different. Think of the announcements by the angels and so on early on. This passage, the occasion when he was aged 12 and disappeared off to the temple for several days. She must have known, but she must have sometimes wondered what was happening. And as Jesus went off, age 30, to his ministry, she must seriously have wondered where it was leading. And don't we all have, mothers and fathers particularly, that sort of concern, for our children? We have, I suppose, hopes and dreams of what they're going to be and how they're going to be turn out, and won't it be wonderful? Sometimes they're fulfilled, hopefully more often than not. Occasionally they're not. And that can be painful. That can be very painful. It was painful for Mary. Remember, she was at the foot of the cross when many of the disciples weren't. It occurred to me a couple of examples to illustrate that. After I'd retired from full-time work, I went to work for 2 or 3 years, actually, on a sort of very part-time basis, to help out at a local hostel for ex-offenders. Now, to put that down in plain language, it's men who'd been in prison and had nowhere to go when they came out. Interesting exercise. I just want to quote a couple of examples, though. One young man, done 2 or 3 years in prison before he came to us. His story, he lived somewhere in the Northwest, in a relatively sort of working class area. And I forget the precise offence, but it involved assaulting somebody in their own home. And he'd been charged with it, caught, charged with it. And of course, inevitably what happened is that the offence got reported in all the local papers. But he argued he was innocent, so everything went ahead until he came to court, where he was found guilty. And this too was reported in the local papers, at which point he was sent off to prison. Now, I want you to think about this, not from his point of view for a moment, but from the point of view of his parents and his family. What it feels like to be there, knowing your son's just been sent to prison and everybody else in the street knows about it. Everybody you meet. That can take a bit of coping with. And his family clearly struggled to cope, because what happened was that he'd gone to prison and he wrote letters home, as he would, and he got replies back for the first few weeks. And he wrote one letter home, and lo and behold, it was returned with "not at this address" written across the envelope. So he thought, post office have got it wrong, you know, delivered it somewhere else, tried again. And this one came back with "gone away, no longer at this address" written on it. They had very literally up sticks moved on what we used to call the moonlight, I think. Up sticks moved right out of the area, not told anybody else in the area where they were going, taking great care actually to hide where they were going. But they hadn't told him either. And they never did tell him. So when he came out of prison, he had no idea where his family was. I can see why they did it. I'm not judging right or wrong, and I've never been in that situation. But that is one possible reaction. We can react that way if we just can't face what we're up against. There was another of our residents who I knew rather better. As I recall, his crimes have been even worse. I can't remember the details now, but he'd done 5 or 6 years in prison, so they must have been. And he came out. Now, one of the things that it was my job to do was occasionally go with him and take him to visit his parents, because that's where he wanted to go. And I went and met this couple, old, elderly, retired couple, and they were absolutely lovely, particularly his mother. And it turned out that he always pleaded his innocence, even when he was with us. He said he'd never done it. But his mother accepted that the view of the court, that he was guilty, that he deserved to go to prison, that he should have, it was right. You know, sometimes you see on the television people say, "Oh, no, you know, protesting the innocence, we're going to..." She wasn't going to. She accepted it quite calmly. But what they had done was carefully, and he'd been moved around the country, around various prisons over the years, kept in touch with him. Whenever he was at a prison within reach, they would go at least from time to time to visit him. And they were still there. Now, there were various reasons why the probation service wouldn't let him go back to his home area. But they were still willing to keep in touch with him. She was as puzzled as anybody else as to why he was like he was. And she admitted, as he did, that he'd always been a bit of a tearaway all his life. You know, he was the sort of child, apparently, who when he was at school, the teachers were more likely to find him up a tree in the grounds than somewhere else. He'd always been like that. Why had he gone so bad in the end? She didn't know. But she didn't judge. And I think secretly, right to the end, she was still hoping that one of these days he would sort of come out of it, settle down and live a somewhat more normal life. Whether he ever did, I don't know. I lost track with them and then I finished my job there. But I was always struck by her and her attitude. She displayed that sort of loyalty, which only perhaps I think a mother can display. Against all the evidence, she wasn't going to let go. She was going to go on caring, loving, to the end. Those two qualities then, a resourcefulness and a loyalty. And I think particularly from that latter one, it's something that we can all learn. Because those are qualities which we can all show, we can all use, particularly not judging, particularly not condemning people, but going on welcoming them. But after all, isn't that a wonderful picture of what God does for each one of us? How often must he look at us and think, oh dear. But he doesn't give up. He waits, he hopes, for us to come back. So I think we have a very clear illustration there of not just of God's love for us, but of how we are called to behave towards others, to each other and to those we meet. In that reading from Colossians, we find this verse here. Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. And then the key sentence, I think, for me. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. Go on forgiving, loving, accepting, waiting. If we do that, I think we can all learn lessons from the examples of Mothering Sunday. I'm going to ask you to stand and sing in response the hymn which